CataractClips.com podcast series, episode number 156, with Dr. John Jarstad. Sunshine Crosslink, the Array multifocal lens, how it all started, plus, of course, the Zombie Double Tap, something I use every single week.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I got a really special guest, a true pioneer, a global surgical diplomat. That's Dr. John Jarstad from Tampa. He's not just a surgeon, he's an innovator. He helped design the very multifocal lens that you don't even know about. We're going to tell you about that. He's a humanitarian. He taught surgery in 25 countries, including the story I have to ask you about is North Korea and your game of eight ball billiards. And then today he's here to tell us about such incredible innovations. And I got to be first to say, I have an admission. I copied something from you. I heard you lecture maybe 5 years ago about the zombie double tap. I stole that from you. I used it on every case. And I think it's genius. Now we got to tell everyone what the heck that is. Well, anyway, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jude. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, I mean, so you're obviously an incredible anterior segment surgeon. Very, obviously, very skilled, very well-traveled worldwide. But you know what? That little pearl I learned from you, I've used it for the last 5 years to help thousands of patients. Could you tell our audience, what is the John Jarstad zombie double tap technique for cataract surgery?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is something I kind of came up with my residents. And we were trying to estimate what the pressure was at the end of a case. And then I got the idea, well, why don't we do a study and see how accurate that is when the residents would estimate it. And then we check it with a tonneau pen with a sterile cover just to see how close they could be. And some of them were pretty darn close. I had one guy that he was able to get within like 5 points just by palpation. But most of them were way off. I remember we said, you know, we want it between 16 and 21. And what do you think the pressure is? And they'd say, well, I think it's 20. And it would be like 67. And another time they'd say, well, it seems a little high. I think it must be in the 30s. And it would be 8. So we did a study that was published, I think it was 2017, which showed that it was impossible to predict the pressure just by palpation.
Right.
And another thing we found was, so we did this study, all these patients, and we graphed it out, and it looked like a scatter plot when we estimated by palpation. And then when we actually, there's two other ways of checking. One, there's a sterile barokeratinometer, which is pretty cheap, about $400. And then there's the tonneau pen, which is like $4,000. So when I'm teaching this in the developing countries, they can't afford a tonneau pen. But sure, they can afford a sterile barokeratinometer that's with the rings from 15 to 21. So that worked. And those correlated really well. It was like a straight line. So that was the thing. And then besides that, what we found, surprisingly, was that these patients had a really low incidence of CME, way lower than what we would have expected, like 1% or less. And so that was published. And, you know, it did get an award at ASCRS in 2019 as the top paper in cataract surgery. So, but yet, you know, you think you publish something once and everybody's going to adopt it. But I find that almost nobody does. I mean, even in our own department, there's a few doctors who don't check the pressure. And so it eliminates the number one complication of cataract surgery, which is pressure spikes on day one. And so that's allowed me to take over Friday surgeries, which nobody wants. You know, we don't check them post-op till Monday, but they're safe. We haven't had anybody with a high pressure spike. And then the second thing was CME, which was phenomenal that it reduced that. And we also found that when there was this supply chain shortage, you know, Whitpen in 1989 came up with a study that showed that NSAIDs would prevent CME, but he didn't break it out into diabetics versus non-diabetics. And so there was a supply chain shortage for a year. And our chairman at Missouri, Rick Kronfelder, said, oh, I never use NSAIDs anyhow. So I thought we'd do a study there and see if they were really necessary because we didn't use them for a year. And what we found was if it was a routine case, you didn't need them. But if it was a diabetic, they had an eightfold increase of CME if you did not use an NSAID. So that was what we found from that. So those are just a couple of pearls that we just discovered. But the double tap, at the end of a case, I have the residents overfill the eye and then go quickly in and out of the side port. You have to go really fast and go in and out, and then the pressure, it's like safe every time. It's like, 16 to 20, something like that.
Well, the genius of it is, if the eye pressure is high, let's say 50, 60, 70, when you go in the para quickly with the 27 gauge blunt cannula, the fluid egresses faster, more.
Right.
And then you do it the second time. And I, by golly, I copied this from you probably 5 years ago. Used it on 100% of cases. There's no post-op day one pressure spike.
Yeah. Yeah. It works great. And it's just, the other thing we found was we had an industrial engineer look at the time and cost savings. And it averaged out about $44,000 a year to each ophthalmologist who used it because they didn't have to go find a lid speculum and a cannula, and tap the eye in the office.
Right, right. So here's the beauty. We'll have your podcast. This is going to premiere on a Sunday. The day after, if you listen to the podcast the day it launched, tomorrow's video is going to be exactly this, the zombie double tap. We'll feature that video. We'll show you everything. You'll learn how to do this. I have personally used it for thousands of cases, and I will never go back to the old-fashioned way.
It works.
Yeah, it's actually brilliant. Now, where does zombie come from? I don't send zombie.
Well, we had to decide that it had to be twice that we tapped it. So I told the residents, this is a double tap. And then Woody Harrelson movie came out, Zombie right. Double Tap. And I just thought, well, that's a good way to remember it.
Oh, yeah. Because you're right. I do it twice. So basically, you go to your para. At the end of the case, you slightly overfill the eye, get it really firm. You go in the para with a 27 gauge cannula, just kind of in and out once.
Yep.
And then in and out again.
Yep.
And by golly, every time your pressure is like somewhere in the 16 to 20 range, it's done. Just every time.
My residents are amazed because when they come in with me, they're doing cataract surgery a lot of times for the first time. And I always ask them with a kind of a rhetorical question. So do you think you'll ever use this when you get into practice? They always laugh and they go, oh my gosh, absolutely.
Right.
Why would I not,
Well, we will publicize the heck out of it here. I mean, as cataract coach is huge, it's global, it's worldwide. And our YouTube or Insta or Facebook or LinkedIn, all that, it'll blow up. I promise. Because I can certainly personally vouch that it made my life way better. I mean, I've not seen an IOP spike on post-op day one in years.
Yeah. It works, and it's really a relief. And I've seen a few patients who were referred who ended up with optic atrophy because they didn't have their pressure checked, for a week or two. And I understand in England now, some of the cataract surgery requirements there is they don't follow up and do any post-op visits. For they say, call if there's a problem. So
I don't know. You can walk around with a pressure of 50, not even dang know it.
Yeah. So I think it's something that's going to help a lot of people. If it can save one patient from going blind from high pressure, I'm all for it.
Well, as you said, it makes your life much easier. Because I know as a surgeon, I'm not going to have post-op day one pressure spikes. I'm just not.
No.
If I'm careful to remove the viscoelastic, I do the double tap the other case, I just know post-op day one, IOP is going to be normal.
Yeah.
And my IOP is checked by my staff. So when I walk into post-op day one patient, IOP is already checked. So it's not like me. I don't have to it's already written down. It's like I've not seen a high pressure over 21 in years.
Yeah. It's great. So we just kind of stumbled upon that. And I got to give credit to my residents for collecting a lot of the data and being willing to, estimate and follow up and keep records of their pressure pre and post op. The other thing we found is that one of the other things out of the study is we found that usually the pressure was within about 5 points of what we measured in the OR. Right. And so I had my chairman, I asked him when I was a resident, I said, why do patients have a pressure spike after surgery? Is it because of viscoelastic? And he said, Richard Brubaker is a great glaucoma surgeon. He said, no, we had pressure spikes before viscoelastic was even invented.
Right.
Yeah. So he says, maybe you can figure it out. And so I took that to heart and I thought, yeah, I think that answers the question. The pressure you see post-op is what you left them with on the OR, on the table.
Yeah, now, as a fellow professor, former professor, who taught residents for 22 years, and you've done it for even longer, that takes a special kind of grit and strength and coronary artery stamina to not get stressed out. So, I mean, you taught, many more years than I have. After 22 years of teaching residents, to be frank, a few years ago, I tapped out. I'm like, thank you. I had enough. Let someone else do this. But you're still going.
Yeah, I got my first heart stent this year in a diagonal branch, a little tiny one. And it's just like, I get the residents for their very first surgery.
So that's so stressful. It's so stressful.
But I found a good way to kind of eliminate the stress. So I kind of follow the recommendations, and you may have come up with this, is I kind of teach backwards. So I have them put the IOL in first and then finish. And then, you know, we go from there. And then we do the front part of the surgery with the incision and the capsulorhexis and hydrodissection. And then the phaco is the last thing. And right. And one thing that's really helped me is I do a larger rexus, and then I have them dislocate the lens. I call it a lens tilt, where you just mm-hmm. tilt up the lens near the paracentesis, put a little viscoelastic under there. And then I have them put their second instrument, the Connor wand or whatever, underneath that, and then go right to quadrant removal and then just debulk the thing and keep them, you know, keep them going. And that's really, when I get people twice, I get them as a fairly new resident, then I get them right before they graduate. And so before they graduate, I tell them, you know, there's not much more I can teach you other than efficiency ideas. So I was in private practice for 20 years, and I went back into academics when I started in academics. So I say, this is what you need to do. When you send your audition video to your prospective employer, they want to see that you can do a cataract in, you know, 15, 20 minutes at least. And right. Most of mine are 7 to 10 minutes when they graduate. So they're employable.
Well, that's an important thing. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I finished residency, you didn't have that. But right now, I think 100% of residents, you must be prepared that your potential employer or your group you want to join is going to ask you, hey, send me 5 to 10 videos of you operating.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
I did that for everybody that joined my practice in Seattle and my private practice there. And, you know, some of them were a little slow, but at least I knew they were safe and, you know, had good hands from the video.
Right, so right.
Speed will come. Like my track coach said, work on the basics and the speed will come.
Well, I think that's the truth. I mean, if you have good technique, then the efficiency, you know, you work on that. But speed's never your focus. Speed's a byproduct of being a good, efficient, safe surgeon.
Yeah.
You have other good pearls too, though, for efficiency in the OR. One thing I liked of yours is you're big on the soaked pledget. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so the nurses love it. So what we did was we put in a metal medicine cup. We put all the drops in at the beginning of the day, and we put the pledgets in there and then soak them. And then we just put that, an anesthetic drop in the eye, and then just put the pledget in. And so all these, you know, three times of 4 or 5 drops, that's kind of eliminated. And we get just as good a dilation, which is what we want. So,
you'll put in like phenylephrine, tropicamide, you'll put in some antibiotic, maybe an NSAID, maybe a paracaine or tetracaine. You put it all together in a steel medicine cup, throw in these little pledgets, and then just put one under each eyelid for every patient.
Right. And just leave it there after, right when they check in. So they're well dilated by the time they get back into surgery.
That's really smart, because you can think how much work it is for the nurses to put in like these, open these 4 bottles and put all these drops in and do it again 5 minutes later and again 5 minutes later. It's like, what?
Yeah. And the patients appreciate it, I think. And my wife tells me not to tell any stories about ourselves, but we were voted the number one ASC in the state of Florida this year for 2026.
Wow.
So the patients appreciate, you know, the staff is really great. And one thing I've done for the staff is, you know, they don't get to see the patients post-op. So we take off, I still put patches on because patients, I went patchless for a long time, for, you know, a couple of months. And the patient said, you know, I really appreciated having the patch on my first eye. I got a lot more attention. You know, I didn't get anybody about me. You know, so I went back to the patch just because of that. And so we take the patch off, and the patient who we had a guy today who could just see light and dark. He's, you know, had traumatic cataract, and we take the patch off, and he's like 20/50 on the first day. And so we had a gal who was 20, you know, a lot of them are 20/20, and they're so excited. And so I would say, you know, they start in, they say, oh, that experience was so great, and I can see so, and I'd say, okay. And the staff was so wonderful. I say, okay, hold on. Do you mind if we video that? So I took that. And I said, okay, can you take it from the top and say that again? And then I'll share that video with the nurses downstairs. Oh, and they love that. they just like, oh man. And so I think that's one thing that we did that kind of helped. And plus the pressure was on me because I'm the director of all outpatient surgery for both Tampa General and University of South Florida now.
After that's stress.
A couple of recommendations, you know, it's like the military. You take everybody take you standing there and everybody takes a step backwards and you're sitting there volunteering. So anyhow, but it's been really good. And we have such a great staff and they take pride in their work, which is really important, I think.
Well, it's nice to be the chief, but the other side of the coin though is all the problems are your problem.
Yeah, the hiring and firing, I thought I was getting away from by going back into academics, which was kind of the tough part of the job in private practice. But, you know, it's they have good administrators who take care of that here. So that makes it a little easier.
But even that's unusual. It's very usual to find a doctor who does private practice and then goes back into academics. That's actually very unusual.
Yeah, I started out that way and I found out later that a lot of my residents were older than I was. I didn't know enough really. I didn't really understand. We were kind of learning FACO together and things and now it's kind of fun. I thought, well, I'd always planned to go back into academics and I had a pretty active academic private practice too. So we'd have fourth year students rotate for their ophthalmology rotation because I was with University of Washington for 6 years and then we got students that would come through. And so I always kind of kept my hand into it and researching with some of the IOLs that were developed, like the first multifocal. I was involved in that.
Hi, the Array
group that, yeah, we kind of invented that with the Fresnel prism effect. But and then the teledioptric lens, I was in the FDA phase one study of that for macular degeneration. I actually had a guy who had a small area of macular degeneration, about 1/4 disc diameter, and he could only see like 2200. And we put this teledioptric lens in and he was like 20/25 reading. So that was pretty remarkable. So there's been a lot of things and I've enjoyed the research part. And then I thought it would really be fun to go back into academics when I actually know something, have something to offer the residents. Right. And you know, like most people, my dad was in business, owned a ski and motorcycle shop, and he would go up every Christmas and donate a lot of ski clothes to the, you know, the boys' ranch. And I said, Dad, why do you do that? That's a lot of, you know, money and equipment and things. He goes, well, son, when you've done well, you have an obligation to help others. So that always kind of stuck in my mind. And I thought, you know, ophthalmology has been really good to me. So I should give back a little bit.
Well, you're doing so in a huge way. And certainly there at TGH, which is Tampa General Hospital. Boy, you work hard.
That's a huge place.
Oh, my God. The trauma cases I've seen that come out of that hospital are unbelievable.
Oh, my gosh. Last summer, we had a guy who's a fishing captain for tourists. And somebody jerked the hook back, and it went right through his cornea, through his iris, through his lens, and out through the sclera about 4.5-5 millimeters back. So we got the retina too. And it was a big hook and it had a feather jig on the end of it. And so it was so firm, I had to get the orthopedic resident on call to come up with the bolt cutters to cut it while I steadied the hook. And then we were able to back it out. And then it took like 3 sutures to close the cornea. Then I cryoed around the retina hole. And the guy, of course, developed a cataract 3 months later. We took that out. And he got 20/25 vision uncorrected.
No way.
20/20 with a little, you know, astigmatism. So that was like the miraculous case of the year. And he said, yeah, anytime your guys want to come fishing, let me know.
Well, that patient better be very thankful because not only gave him his vision back, but his case took a week off your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he better be very thankful.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
That's super stressful. So tell us, you mentioned you were involved in, you know, basically the first multifocal IOL we had. Yeah. I'm old enough back in the late 1990s to have actually implanted the Array lens.
Yeah.
ARRAY, the Array lens at the time made by AMO, which then was it American Medical Optics or Advanced Medical Optics?
Yeah, Allergan Medical Optics, then Advanced, and then Johnson & Johnson bought them, I guess.
And then it went to Abbott, became Abbott Medical Optics, yeah. Then Johnson & Johnson bottom. Yeah. So you were way, 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 way back then. So I guess coming on 30 years ago, tell us about the Array lens and your involvement in that, because what you contributed changed the way we now develop multifocal lenses.
Yeah, so they called the chief residents from 10 programs to come to Irvine, California, to the headquarters, and we got to visit the Western White House where Nixon, you know, had lived.
Sure.
And they said, "Bring your ideas. We're trying to find a way to make a lens with a thinner profile that we can turn into like a multifocal or something." And so I remembered the Fresnel prism effect from residency, where if you cut a prism at the apex and stack them, you know, base to end, you can really use that thinning down. So I came, this was like right before PowerPoint. So I brought this overhead transparency when I had the three views, like from shop class and junior high.
Yeah.
I had like the circles on the top view and then the side view that showed the, you know, the ripples and everything. And after I did my presentation, they didn't really say much, but their head optics person, PhD, said, "Can I talk to you about that lens now? Let me see if I understand what you're saying." And so I went over it again, and he said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Seattle." He says, "Were your parents from there?" I go, "Yeah." He said, "Where'd they go to high school?" And it was in Port Orchard, Washington, which is a school of about 300 students. He said, "I knew your mom. She was our student body president."
No way.
I think I went out with her once, and she won the election by driving her brother's Jeep through the hallways and getting expelled from school.
So no way.
That's how I remember. So it's kind of a small world.
Wow. So they incorporate your design, and that Fresnel prism design became basically this array lens, which is a refractive multifocal lens that was in basically the late 1990s.
Right. Yeah. So that was kind of the early iteration of it. And then they kind of used the same thing with the teledioptric lens, although that had, you know, a Galilean telescope. So that was a -5 in the center and a +20 carrier lens. And so that worked pretty well for patients with small field defects in the center.
So then the array lens from AMO at the time that was used for a while. And people don't realize that prior to May of 2005, those lenses, they cost the same. A multifocal cost the same as a monofocal. There was no difference in price.
Yeah.
You didn't pay patients extra. You just did it. You did it for the love of the game.
Yeah.
And then that became then when Medicare passed in 2005, the CMS allowed billing for out of pocket for presbyopia treatment and astigmatism.
Right.
Then that became the kind of slightly revamped. It became the Resume lens.
Correct. Yeah. And so what we did, because you had to justify the higher cost of, you know, whatever it was, $975 or $1,000. And so we listed all of the tests and how much they cost that we would go in pre-op. So we would do a topography, we'd do a IOL master, we'd do OCT, all these tests so that we could show. And then a LASIK enhancement or a PRK enhancement afterwards. 5% of patients needed that. So we factored in all those costs to come up to justify the $975.
Right. And you know what? To be frank, at the time, those lenses worked pretty well.
Yeah.
They really did, actually.
There were some happy patients with those.
Right. And those since then, you know, have evolved into like basically like for the AMO line, the Tecnis multifocal variants, like the Odyssey, the Synergy, also the Alcon lens became the Restore, then the Panoptix Pro. So all these kind of developed from that. And now I guess we have in the U.S. also the Bausch Lomb NV. So we have a lot of options now. But it all started from that.
Yeah, that was something I look back on and I thought, my gosh, they used my idea, you know.
Eight.
And there's a few things that I've patented, but there's some that I just developed and then the company patented it or changed it just a little bit. So that's not bad. I mean, the crystal lens, the inserter for the crystal lens I came up with when Andy Corley came to my office and he said, you know, you've invented a few things. What would be the ideal way to put a lens into the eye? And I said, well, you'd want to use something disposable because everything's going that way.
Right.
And back then they had those twisty things, two-handed things, or just back then we were using forceps to fold the lens like a taco shell, put it in and then unfold it. And sometimes it wouldn't release, so you had to get a Sinsky hook to let it go. But anyhow, so I drew it on the whiteboard and I said, and it'd have to have a tapered tip so it'd go through a small incision. But I said, the most important thing is it should be spring-loaded. So when you're pushing on it, it doesn't just suddenly shoot into the eye and go through the bag and into the retina. He says, oh, could you draw that on the whiteboard? So I did, and 2 months later, he came back with his prototype, and he said, is this what you had in mind? And I said, oh, yeah. I said, let's try it out. So we tried it out, worked pretty well, and My version would load it, you know, front to back like that. And their version to get the patent different was to insert it from the side.
Load it from the side. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So anyhow, I'm just happy it's still in use after, you know, like 20 years or whatever. So anyhow, it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, young ophthalmologists may not realize, because our cataract coach and the podcast is actually geared mostly to ophthalmologists, you know, in their 30s and 40s, some in their 50s.
Yeah.
But they may not realize the intellectual property, the patent areas around IOL injectors is very tight.
Yeah, yeah.
It is really tight to not step on someone else's toes or step on someone else's patent or someone else's IP. And so it's kind of tough to make these ideas. But you're a classic example. I always say, like, ophthalmologists are so dang smart. Like, the only way I can keep up is just to work harder. Because I'm not that smart. I've not invented any of this stuff.
And sometimes, you know, you have to go back to, you know, thinking outside the box and using what you've learned in other fields. Like, I was a commercial fisherman, which came in handy on the guy with the fishhook injury.
Right.
Because I knew that I was going to need an orthopedic bolt cutter to get that size hook off. And people said, gosh, how would commercial fishing ever relate to eye surgery? Well, I came up with this fisherman's knot for repairing iris tears. And it's based on a clinch knot from fishing. So instead of doing the Siepser knot, I just put my needle through, pull it out the other end, grab a loop, and then I twist the loop 5 times and put the needle through the loop and then pull it across. And that works just as well as, you know, I came up with that on the Navy hospital ship when I took a 4-month sabbatical teaching. And I got an emergency call from the OR when I finished my shift. And he said, we can't get this knot to work. And the doctor on the ship would tie it one way. He said, do you remember the Siepser knot? Because every time I try to tie it, it unties. And so I said, well, let's come up with this other idea and just twist it 5 times, pull it through, and it locks on. So,
well, that's a smart idea, right? You bring the loop out of the eye, twist the loop itself 5 times.
Yeah. And just put the needle through. And then I do a back throw. I grab one more. I put one more twist in it and do a back throw so it's a locking knot. Kind of like tying your shoe.
Who would have ever thought the commercial fishing would tie it so well to ophthalmology? I mean, who would have thought? It's like this, you can't make this up. Now, John, I also learned that you wrote a book. Tell us about your book.
Yeah, so I would go to these places like North Korea and Africa, and patients would, I'd tell them a little snippet of story, and they'd say, wow, that's fascinating. You should write a book. And it got so much that I finally did, and it's called Eye to Eye, and it was voted a bestseller at our faculty book of the month club, and also it was a finalist for book of the year on Barnes and Noble.
Wow.
So it basically kind of details some of these 55 mission trips that I've gone to as a visiting professor teaching cataract surgery around the world, and kind of goes into more depth of the stories I told on your podcast. So,
and we can find the book on Amazon or online easily, right?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Christian Faith Publishers is the one that published it. And there's also a electronic version for $9 that's available. So,
send me the links. I'll put the links down below for all our listeners and viewers. If you definitely want to check this book, I'm going to check it out for sure. The link's going to be down below in the description. Talking about your time on this naval ship, but you've actually taught surgery done surgery around the world.
Yeah, so that was 4 months. I talked to my partners and I said, hey, would you guys cover for me for 4 months? They asked me to lead a team of volunteers on this 4-month thing to Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Okay. And I thought, well, I speak Indonesian, so that would
you
be
speak helpful. Indonesian? How's that?
Saya akan makan siang sekarang.
You got to tell. How do you speak Indonesian?
Well, I've been there like 14 times. I love that place.
Wow.
But anyhow, I got invited one day. I just got a phone call from one of the doctors in Seattle, and he says, hey, we're going to North Korea. We're wondering if you'd like to go and teach eye surgery in North Korea. I said, you mean South Korea? He said, no, North. I said, I didn't think we could go there as Americans. He said, well, normally you can't, but blah, blah, blah. If you're part of a humanitarian team, we have a hospital we built there up near the Russian border. And if you send them all your certificates and diplomas and everything. They'll let you in. It takes about 4 months for them to approve you. And I thought, man, you got my attention. Trip of a lifetime. So I went the first time, and I remember one guy that we operated on, his cataract was so dense, you know, a big white cataract in both eyes. Right. And so he could only tell when the sun came up and when it came down. That was it. And so we did his surgery, and we got, you know, donated lenses. And he just so happened to get a crystal lens, which was one that fit his prescription. Oh, and the other thing I did was, I didn't know if they'd have a keratometer over there. Mm-hmm. And so I have a pocket A-scan that's in a Palm Pilot. Okay. And then for the K readings, just in case they didn't have a keratometer, I took 30 of my Korean American patients and averaged their K readings, and it was 44.5. So I used that for the Ks, did the A scan with this pocket thing, and we got great results. So this guy put the crystal lens in. So he gets a cataract surgery from a Mayo Clinic trained surgeon with the highest crystal lens, you know, to make. And the day after surgery, we're taking his bandage off, and he's like 20-25 on day one. And he starts talking really fast in Korean. Well, I speak a little Korean, so I could understand a little bit, but I couldn't understand exactly what he said. So I asked the interpreter, what was he saying? And she said, well, he's saying he was told he had to remain blind because he had an incurable condition. And so now he says he can see so well, he can't believe anything his government tells him. And so I have a patient who worked for the CIA. And I was telling him that story, and he goes, God, that's the best kind of backdoor diplomacy we could ask for.
Wow, what a wild story. You know, you have other clever tricks too, though. Talking about biometry, you have a clever trick, like in a trauma patient, of estimating the IOL power. You gotta spill the beans here. Teach us the secrets.
Yeah, so this kind of came up out of reviewing some charts. And I know in a lot of places, somebody just puts in a 19. Well, I asked the patient to bring their glasses that they've ever had, and I would take half their prescription. Let's say they were a minus five, and I would use that half of that prescription, so minus 250, and I would subtract that from 19. So I'd get like 17.5 or whatever it is. And I just did a case like that the other day. Somebody's in a stretcher. They can't move. They're in a, you know, assisted living, and they've got a really dense cataract, and you know, no way to get an A scan on them that would be reliable. And they came in post-op on Monday from a Friday surgery. And they were 20/25 uncorrected. So I've done that a few times.
You know, 19 plus half their RX. Yeah. So if they're minus six, it'd be 19 minus three plus negative three, which would be 16. And if they're a plus four, let's say 19, and then plus four, let's say add two, so you're like 21.
21. Yeah. That's so I've done that several times, and to me, it seems a little better than just putting a 19 in and fixing it. Yeah. So maybe I'm on a lucky streak, but
maybe. Well, I would always err on this. I said, listen, I have a bias. I'm a minus two myope, so I'm very biased. I love minus two. That's why I'm enjoying my laptop right now with no glasses.
Yeah.
At the age of 50 something. But that's so true. I'd always say, listen, just put in a 20. When in doubt, increase the IOL power. Myopia is a gift.
Yeah. No, I try to fudge up a little bit on people, especially if they've been myopic, you know, most of their life before their cataract. So, yeah, they like that. But back to North Korea, when I was there, I was surprised we would play pool at night in the hotel. And then one night, Kim Jong-un shows up with his two bodyguards.
Whoa.
And I knew who he was right away because his portrait was everywhere in every building with his father. And so I ran over to him and I said, hey, I'm John Gerson. I'm an eye surgeon from the U.S. He said, they call me Mr. Kim. I said, okay, Kim, want to have a game of eight ball, stars and stripes? He says, yes, American, I will play you and I will beat you. I said, okay, Kim, bring it on. And so we were playing, and if he missed a shot, he'd swear or use profanity, you know. And I said, Kim, your language is kind of colorful. Where'd you learn to speak your English? But he had really good English. So I was really surprised. And he says, well, John, as you know, I studied in Switzerland and most of my friends were British and American. So we'd go out drinking on the weekends. I said, oh, okay. That kind of explains it. So I had him beat by three balls because I used to play pool in high school. And I had a perfect shot, eight ball in the corner pocket to win the game. And I'm pulling back the cue stick and I'm thinking, do I really want to sink this shot?
Right. Right.
So I just barely missed it on purpose. And okay. He said, ha, 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 I beat you just as I predicted, American. And I shook my hand. I said, I'll get you next time, Mr. Kim.
So, oh, I love it. You said, sometimes you got to do what's right, you know, for the sake of your mission. Right.
Diplomacy. Diplomacy.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. What an unbelievable story.
Yeah, some of those things I just can't believe happened. But and then another one was when before we were fighting against the Taliban and Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden flew over with one of his fighters to my Seattle office, and he shows up with his, you know, turban and his white robe, and he says, "This is one of my Mujahideen fighters. He needs to have cataract surgery. Will you do it?" I said, "I'd be honored. Sure, you came a long ways." And he said, "How much will it cost?" I said, "Well, our law says we have to charge a dollar more than Medicare." So he pulls out this envelope, this white envelope, and it's full of like 40 crisp new $100 bills. I didn't know if they were real or not. I assumed they were. I didn't see anything wrong with them. And so he counts them and he says, "Will this be enough?" I said, "Yes." And so he said, "When can we do the surgery? Today?" I said, "Well, has he eaten breakfast already?" He said, "Yeah." "So we'll do him tomorrow." He says, "Okay." So we do his eyes tomorrow. He says, "How long must we stay?" I said, "Well, it'd be really nice if we had a post-op day or two." I said, "Okay, we can stay 3 days." So he stayed and then he left. And I didn't realize, you know, a lot of us have photographic memories in ophthalmology because we're looking at, you know, optic nerves and retinas and everything from month to month or year to year. And so I saw him on TV for the first time and go, "That's the guy." You know, he's like 6'5" and about 165, 170 pounds, pretty rail thin. And I thought, my gosh, that guy came to our clinic. You know, so that was pretty wild. So
that's wild. That's wild.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You meet a lot of people in ophthalmology. I met Bashir Assad at the Academy meeting in Dallas.
This is the ophthalmologist who is or was president of Syria,
dictator of Syria. Yeah. Wow. And so the year they were talking about satellite offices, and I said, "Where's your office? Is it in Damascus?" He said, "Yeah." Said, "Well, what do you think about satellite offices?" He said, "Well, you know, if I can be honest with you, I would just really like to just be an ophthalmologist the rest of my life." And I played dumb because you can recognize him pretty easily. He's pretty tall and he has that small round head. And I said, "Well, why couldn't you?" And he says, "Well, it's a little complicated. You see, we have this family business in Syria, you know, like running the country."
Wow. So that was
fun. I kind of wish I'd taken up his offer, though. He invited me to come over and teach FACO, and I was, you know, just setting up my own clinic at the time, and so it didn't work out. But it would have been kind of fun to see, you know, the situation there.
Where else have you been, you know, to teach surgery or perform surgery? Because you've done a lot of countries, dozens of countries.
Yeah, all over Africa. I was in my first trip was to Zimbabwe, believe it or not.
Wow.
And you know, everything from lion bite injuries to war injuries and things. And then Egypt, that was kind of fun. And Angola, Madagascar was interesting. They only have 24 ophthalmologists for 24 million people.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah. 1 million patients per ophthalmologist.
Yeah, so no shortage of work there. And I think one of the fun ones was Kyrgyzstan. So I mean,
I couldn't point on a map, to be honest.
Yeah, it's kind of over in southern part of what used to be the Soviet Union. And so when I was in, I don't speak Kyrg, but I heard a few of the older patients speaking Russian, which I can speak Russian. So after that, I started doing
Russian too?
Yeah,
Indonesian, Korean, some Russian too?
What? Хорошо? Смотрит глаза.
Wow, you're blowing me away. This is proof positive that every ophthalmologist is a genius except for me. And this is proof.
That's not true. I've got a good story about somebody that I taught cataract surgery to in Indonesia. He was in a residency program there. And Devi Mandaji. And he was on the island that looks like a German swastika.
Okay.
Monaco, at the very northern tip. And I went there and I guess every program teaches a little differently, but his attending was told him that he said, "I'm no good with my hands. They think I should go into neuro-ophthalmology or do plastics." And I said, well, let's do a couple of cases. We did a couple of blepharoplasties, and he had great hands. So I said, Debbie, do you want to learn cataract surgery? He said, yeah, yeah. So we taught him that. And then I went back 6 months later on the hospital ship. And we have that happened to be one of the ports that we stopped in. And so I gave him a little refresher then. And then he took off and he studied your videos for like 2 or 3 years. Wow. And he is now the number one volume cataract surgery in the country.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he does 50 cataracts a day, 6 days a week.
That is amazing. We've actually featured one of his videos on Cataract Coach because I know the name.
Yeah.
Wow, that blows me away.
Yeah. So I was really, really proud of him. I sat with him on his very first case, and he's taken it to another level. When he does a capsular rexus, he grabs the cap. Well, first, when he makes his paracentesis, he stabs the anterior capsule and gets it started. And then he just grabs the forceps, the uterotic forceps, and he just makes one move, one circular move.
Perfect.
Yep, that's it.
Wow.
And he goes.
Better than me. I'm doing 3 grab probably.
Yeah. I know. Same here. That's what I teach the residents. But he is a phenomenal surgeon. And just, you know, seeing him, it's kind of like your kids. You hope they turn out well. And then when they exceed your expectations, then it's like a bonus, you know. So
the magic is what you taught him, the effect, the impact you had with him has helped probably tens of thousands of patients.
Yeah, it's a little humbling because when I go to their meetings, people come up to me and they say, you're the kind of the father of modern cataract surgery in our country. Can I get a photo with you?
Right.
And I'm like, that's a little embarrassing, but yeah, sure, you know, whatever. But one of them told me, one of their leaders in the association, Indonesian Ophthalmology Association, said that of the thousand phaco surgeons in the country, that about 900 could trace their training back to me through either personally or with one of their
amazing
their attendings.
Amazing. That's amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. The impact you have is like sometimes, you know, when you're like a med student or you're a resident, you never imagine that you're going to have this much of an impact worldwide.
Well, think about your videos and what that's done for Debbie, because when I worked with him, he was doing a cataract surgery in about 20 to 30 minutes. And now he's down to like under 10 for everybody. And that's just as a result of, you know, using your videos. And then if there's something that comes up, he used to call me in the middle of the night because it's about 10 hours difference. And he'd say, hey, look at this video. What should we do next? And I'd say, okay, we'll put a little more viscoelastic under the lens. And, you know, and now he hardly ever calls. He says, oh, I'm good. I watched Cataract Coach.
I'm honored. I'm absolutely blessed. But yeah, you know, the beauty is now with modern technology, we've basically equalized or democratized surgical learning worldwide. So there are no more secrets. Whether you train directly under you, you could be one of your residents for a year and have great training, but you could also be in another country on the other side of the planet and have access to the same learning materials.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's been great. I remember when the first visit I went to Indonesia, we did the first no stitch phaco there that had ever been done. And then they were not kind of up to speed. They'd just gotten a phaco machine. So we're kind of teaching them how to use it. And now they're like, they got leading videos and things, and they're speaking at all these meetings, and Debbie's giving courses all over Asia. Based on your cataract coach videos, and he's kind of, you know, tweaking them a little bit this way or that way for the local things, you know, with the real dense cataracts or the white ones or the black ones or whatever. So it is a really great to have that worldwide brotherhood where people can use, you know, they can find out what we do and adopt it right away.
Right.
I remember when I presented the double tap and the IOL or the IOP checking, at the Academy, when they gave the award, they listed it as one of the best video talks. And whoever was giving the presentation said, I like to go to a meeting where I find out something I can use right away when I go home. He said, this next paper is what did it for me at this meeting. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's the best compliment I've ever had in my life. People are using it.
Well, listen, tomorrow's video, we're going to have it go viral in ophthalmology. I promise you that. Because I, like I said, I can personally attest. I learned this from you about 5 years ago. And I said, you know what? Let me give this a shot. And I've done it for thousands of cases in the last 5 years. I'll never stop using it. It's made my life better, made my patients better. No IOP spikes, lowers their CME. It just, why would you not do this?
Yeah, I don't miss patients calling in puking, you know, the night after surgery with a high pressure that I thought was normal.
You know, the funny part is, you know, we always think that our fingertip tonometer is accurate. Like, oh, let me just press, I can tell the pressure. You can't tell anything, you have no idea.
No, our study proved that. And then at that same meeting where I got the compliment, one of the doctors on the panel from Germany said, well, I don't know if I can believe this Jarstead paper because I can just tap on the eye with my finger and I can tell exactly what the pressure is about.
Right, right.
And I thought, go home and try it.
Right? Get your tonometer out. Get a Bearcare tonometer, which will tell you 16 to 21. And then you try it yourself. You cannot. I've tried. You cannot predict.
No. I mean, I've done cataracts. I've done over 30,000 probably. I haven't done like you have, but I've done probably over 30,000 cases. I can't tell when the pressure is high.
No one can tell. We can lie to ourselves, but if we're honest, or like you said, okay, check with your finger. What do you say? A number. Yeah. You think it's 25? Okay, get your tonopan or your tonometer. What's the pressure? You're wrong every time. You can't. I'm convinced you can't predict it because I think I know my fingertip. My fingertip tonometer is not real. It doesn't want to work. Now you for speaking of outpatient surgery, you also have some kind of paradigm shift in the way you approach, let's say, the new normal for patients undergoing surgery. Because let's say you had something involving the Society of Ambulatory Anesthesia, where maybe you don't have to cancel a patient if his blood pressure is 180 over 100 if they're totally asymptomatic.
Right. I went to the Philippines and with the Lions Club, and we were doing about 400 cataracts over the week's time. This, you know, we would check the patient's blood pressure and everybody, they don't have refrigeration on this one island. Okay. So everybody preserved their food and salt. And the average blood pressure was 240 over 120.
Well, what was that?
In our surgery center, we would cancel cases if it was more than 160 over 90. And right. So I said, well, can we give this patient some nifedipine under the tongue or some, you know, labetalol or something? And the anesthesiologist in the Philippines going, no, don't do it. Last time volunteers were here, they put everybody on blood pressure meds. They lasted for a month and they ran out, couldn't afford them. And we had many people had strokes and heart attacks. He says, you got to just treat them where they live. And so you're right. The Society for Ambulatory Anesthesia, SAMBA, came out with a position paper that talked about there's very few reasons to cancel a cataract operation now, unless the patient is symptomatic. So blood pressure, you know, as long as it's kind of where they live. And then there's a big deal about atrial fibrillation. And it's usually newly diagnosed atrial fibrillation.
Right, right.
Or not new atrial fibrillation. They've had it for a while. And I was surprised about the MIs and strokes, because I was always taught in residency, you got to wait 6 months. Now it's 2 weeks for an uncomplicated MI, 3 weeks for a complicated MI. You can have cataract surgery, according to the SAMBA Society for Ambulatory Anesthesia paper. So that's going to help a lot of these cancellations that get needlessly canceled. And we finally got our anesthesia people to agree to that in our system. And so that was tough. That was tough.
Wow, that's a big step then.
Yeah. So, I had to print the paper off a couple of times and hand it to them. And did you read this? Have you read it yet? What do you think? And then finally they read it and they go, God, yeah, that's right. You know, if they're not having symptoms, we're pretty good to go. Because cataract surgery is so safe compared to anything else.
Right. I mean, listen, we've got a procedure where you're doing topical anesthesia. You're in and out in 10 minutes or less. Yeah. It's really not that invasive a procedure. I mean, it's certainly way less than having like a dental cavity filled, right? Come on.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, my wife's a dentist, so she's...
As you know, it's far less than that.
Oh gosh.
It's easy stuff. So the 6 month rule probably doesn't make any more sense, right? The six month rule of wait 6 months after your MI, after this. Don't worry about it.
They really, that's really kind of helped us, I think, in our stuff. You know, one other thing I wanted to mention was hydrating the incision, the walls of the corneal incision after surgery with the antibiotic. And I've been doing that now for about 15 years. And knock on wood, I've not had a single case of endophthalmitis. And I think I recall a rabbit study that was done maybe 20 years ago that showed that if you injected anesthetic or antibiotic into the cornea, stroma, it lasted for about 3 weeks. Whereas if you inject it into the anterior chamber, it is out of there in 20 minutes. So that to me seems like, and then another study showed, I don't know how they did this, maybe radio labeled things, but they found that most bacteria will enter through the sides of the incision. And so I designed a marker that's wider for a tunnel incision that's wider on the edges than it is in the center. So most of the wound leaks came from the corner of the incision. In fact, there was a doctor in Seattle at the university, John Goffman, who was a great surgeon, but he would get some eyes leaking, and the residents called it, it's leaking at Goffman's corner, which was like the edge of the incision. So that's where the bacteria typically would enter. And so if you can hydrate that with the Vigamox, I just think it makes sense because that's going to stick around, according to that rabbit study, for about 3 weeks.
Right, because it's in the stroma, not just floating around the AC. AC turns over every like 90 minutes.
Yeah. So that, you know, you hydrate the stroma, it turns a little bit white. You don't have to do too much, but put it into the stroma through the side port and be sure to angle upwards because I had one resident angling down and tip came off of the cannula and it went through the capsule and into the retina and made a retina. Oh. Here. So we had to do a little photocoagulation there, a little.
We've had catacomb videos of flying cannulae. You got to hold that cannula tip. You got to be very careful. That thing can shoot up like a rocket.
So that's another pearl.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you also had one more brilliant thing. Now, you and I are very fortunate. You there in Florida, me in Los Angeles. We have nice, beautiful, sunny climates. In the modern era where cross-linking costs thousands of dollars, you actually have been very – you brought it to our attention that – maybe riboflavin plus going outside in the natural UV light is enough.
Yeah, so I was happy to see that was finally proven. We kind of went about it backwards. We had a patient who had ectasia after a touch-up, after cataract surgery, and she got progressive ectasia. So we were going to do Avedro. We were one of the phase one FDA study sites for Avedro. And so I told her about it. And at that time, it wasn't covered by insurance. So it was $3,500 per eye. And she broke down and cried. And she said, I can't afford one eye, let alone two. I'm on a fixed income. Have you got anything cheaper and less painful? Because she'd worn contacts and had a corneal abrasion. She said, we've got to give you an abrasion and put the riboflavin drops on. And then we got to hit you with this ultraviolet light. So have you got anything cheaper and less painful? And I thought, well, didn't Plato say necessity was the mother of invention? I thought, you know, I guess you could just take riboflavin pills and then for the ultraviolet, just go outside without your sunglasses for, I don't know, some arbitrary amount, like 15 minutes I chose, and let's see you back in 6 months. And so she came back 6 months later and had exactly the same results as the Avedro. She had 1.5 diopters of flattening. Everything was stable. And I said, my gosh, what did you do? Did you take more riboflavin than I said? Or were you out in the sun longer? She said, well, You had said on a multivitamin, 50 milligrams was good. So if 50 milligrams was good, I thought 500 would be better. Okay. And so that was like almost the magic dose because the largest capsule you can buy is 400 milligrams. So we set up a protocol and then the FDA called me to go, hey, we're calling you about your study and notice you don't have a control group. I said, well, how can we? We either got to have the riboflavin and the sunlight or no riboflavin and sunlight. He said, no, can you just have two different doses, like a smaller dose with the 400? He says, okay, we'll do 100 and 400. And so the ones with 400 had the better cross-linking. And then Dr. Hafizi in Switzerland, he has the International Cross-Linking Conference every December in Zurich. And so I went over there and I presented it. And it got awarded the best research out of the 200 papers from 44 countries. And then he went on further and took freshly enucleated pig eyes and put riboflavin drops on it and then put them out in the sun, and he measured that they cross-linked. And wow. So then the final thing was, does the riboflavin get into the cornea? Okay. And Dr. Silva in Brazil proved that at the ARVO meeting last year, where she found that, and this is what I didn't do, which I should have done, is patients that were headed for a cornea transplant, they had them take our protocol of 400 milligrams a day of riboflavin for 2 weeks before their corneas were removed. And then they were assayed along with the aqueous. And they found extremely high doses of riboflavin in the cornea buttons and also in the anterior chamber. And so that kind of was the missing link that proved the oral riboflavin in our dose of 400 a day got into the cornea. And then Hafizi in Switzerland found that it cross-linked. So that's pretty well proven now. And then the other thing we found out in our study, we did a study and we found that patients would come back for their 3-month visit and they go, hey, is this riboflavin supposed to cure my migraines? And I said, wait a second, what are you talking about?
What?
And they said, well, I haven't had a migraine since I started your protocol. And so now we're treating both atypical ocular migraines and regular migraines with 400 milligrams of riboflavin. And within 3 to 6 months, it cures their migraines. So
this is wild. That's unbelievable.
So it's just like, one of those things. So then our neurology department is seeing some of these migraine patients and they're telling them, yeah, I'm taking, the iClinic's riboflavin and I'm cured. I don't have migraines anymore. And then so they said, hey, what are you guys doing down there? So he sent up this little brochure I made. And they also found that the high-dose riboflavin, the Swedish doctors presented at the ASCRS meeting, and they found that children taking riboflavin and sunlight, it prevented progressive myopia. So it's been a really interesting discovery.
Well, we know sunlight obviously helps prevent myopia too. We've learned that for sure.
Yeah.
It's funny how maybe the sun isn't as bad as we thought. Like even here in Los Angeles, I actually like to get 15 minutes of sun at least every day. I'll wear a hat to keep the sun off my face, but I'll take my shirt off. I'll go for a walk. Let me just enjoy some free vitamin D.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's a very cheap way to cross-link the cornea.
Yeah,
it's $19.99 for a 4-month supply of the 400 milligrams riboflavin on Amazon or NutriCost.com. So,
right. No, that's actually mind blowing. Now, well, I can't believe we've been talking for almost an hour. That's how much fun we've had. It's just fantastic. We've learned so much stuff. If nothing else, every one of our listeners, you better start incorporating the zombie double tap. Because I promise you, I've done it for 5 years now. It's a game changer. You'll never go back. It's a total game changer. But if I could ask you here, if you could go back to the young Dr. Jarstad at Mayo Clinic many years ago, because that's like our young ophthalmologist here, what advice would you give that young version of you?
Wow. That's a tough question. That's a good one. But I would say one of the biggest things is just, do your best and be patient, a little patient. But I had my professor, Robert Waller, who was our chairman, and then he became the head of the whole Mayo Clinic. But he said, he was a Southern gentleman, and he said, John, when you get out into practice, treat all of your patients like a Mayo Clinic patient, and they will beat a path to your door.
Mm-hmm.
So the take-home message was, treat patients with respect. I don't discriminate against anyone. My dad I was fortunate to have a dad who was the TV sports announcer for baseball in Seattle. And then he taught me, he says, I hope you never judge anybody by the color of their skin or where they're from. He says, I judge people by their batting average and their ERA if they're a pitcher.
There you go, baby. It's all merit. You got it.
So I grew up with a dad like that, and that was during the the race riots and things that were going on, and I appreciate that. And I have a lot of patients who refer their brothers and sisters to me, and I really love to get to know them, and I can joke around with them now. They trust me. and things. So we'll talk about things that I would be, you know, totally embarrassed or hesitant to talk about things, you know, if I hadn't had that kind of an upbringing.
Right. No, that's great advice. Great advice. For every young ophthalmologist who listens to this podcast, I can assure you, John and I both agree, we are thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist. Best thing ever.
Amen, brother.
Absolutely. Again, I want to thank you so much for doing this last hour with me. What an incredible conversation. Again, we'll have your zombie double tap video for featured tomorrow on the Cataract Coach series. We'll get that promoted around the world. And again, wow, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks, Uday. Appreciate all that you're doing for our residents and young ophthalmologists all over the world who tune in.
Thank you, sir. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast. You find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, we got a new Cataract Coach video every day. We're almost at 2,900 videos in a row. This summer coming up is going to be video number 3,000 for Cataract Coach. Uh-huh. I never missed a single day. I'm that crazy. So until next time, I'll catch you later.